Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Cenovus.com.
The old world is dying. The new world struggles to be born. Now is the time of monsters. With those words, I welcome you to the Time of Monsters podcast, sponsored by The Nation magazine. Now, one particular monster that has loomed large in the imagination of humanity from time immemorial is the shark. Most famously in Steven Spielberg's classic Jaws, the stuff of nightmares, the remorseless, consciousless predators of the sea that can use human for simple food. One person that has a particular phobia of sharks is the former president, Donald Trump. People will recall, I think, that during the ill-fated romantic liaison or whatever it was with actress Stormy Daniels, Stormy Daniels commented that Trump actually spent a lot of the evening not as I think a normal a person would, enjoying her company, but watching shark documentaries on television and remarking to her, "I hope all the sharks die." Now, former President Trump revisited the issue of sharks in a remarkable performance in Las Vegas among the sweltering heat, in this desert town, really, as far away from sharks as one could possibly be. But he first started talking about the danger of electric batteries on boats, in keeping with his longstanding opposition to electric vehicles, whether they be cars or boats, and how you could get electrocuted in these boats if they sink. But then he, as is his wont, went on this strange digression where he started talking about the sharks and how there are these liberal do-gooders that were like defending the sharks and saying, they only accidentally, if they bite someone, that's only a mistake and not their intent. And then, raising the question, which she said was a good question, and what is preferable, to be electrocuted by these horrible environmental batteries or to be eaten by a shark? And he said, anytime, he will, the shark is the worst, which actually kind of defeated the point he was making about the electric vehicles, because it actually makes the battery seem like not so bad, if those are the options. But in any case, it shows you the depths of his hatred of sharks. This brings me to today's guest, my colleague Chris Lehman, who wrote a column about Trump's speech there, but using it as a larger discussion about Trump's rhetorical mode, the appeal it has to his hardcore base, and the way in which the sort of mainstream media misrepresents it. First of all, Chris, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Jade. Always a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, so let's talk about this a little bit, because what is your take on Trump's latest diatribe against the sharks?
Well, it's interesting. It is one in what seems now an infinite series of, you can go back to, his war on the windmills, or his war on indoor plumbing, or, his war on Bette Midler. Like, there are all of these outbursts that happen at these rallies, and sort of the mainstream political press has, the Charlie Brown and the football response of like, "Oh, we have found an irrational utterance by former President Trump. Surely this will change the tenor of the discourse and the debate." And we're 8 years now into the Trump era, and clearly, I think the intensive focus on what Trump says disregards, you know, what Lloyd Bitzer called the rhetorical situation, which is to say, you know, his followers are really indifferent to whether what he says makes any sense. And I think that's a more interesting and, you know, fruitful mode of inquiry, to sort of ask, what is the nature of this movement in which, you know, very much it, there's an obvious contrast, of course, to draw between what's made of Joe Biden's many rhetorical stumbles on the stump, which, of course, you know, both the Republican noise machine is keen to exploit and the mainstream press plays along. But I think you have to start asking, well, this is more in the nature of a religious cult than a political movement. You know, it's first of all worth noting, as you did, that, you know, this whole deranged little riff came on the heels of Trump, you know, attacking electric vehicles, you know, saying he's going to rescind all the mandates under the Inflation Reduction Act that Biden passed to modernize the inventory of American cars so that they're electric and not, you know, such a direct threat to climate change. And then all of a sudden you wind up here, which is, I think, the interesting, you know, a couple of things are interesting to flag. One is Trump is, again, creating this set piece, I think, out of his imagination in which he is, you know, the brilliant questioner, the same way, you know.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
During COVID, you know, he said, you know, it's you know, doctors are amazed by the things I say. So that is an important thing to flag. Oh, go ahead.
Yeah. Yeah. No, he actually mentioned, I think it's his uncle at MIT, or he has some sort of relation at MIT. And he mentioned that, you know, he raised this question, you know, like, what is worse, to be electrocuted or to be attacked by a shark? And the uncle apparently, who knows if this ever happened, but said, you know, like, I've never heard that question before.
Which is a diplomatic response on the part of, this is evidently something that happened with a boat manufacturer in South Carolina or something. This is, you know, what a polite person does in the presence of dementia, really. Is like, oh, I've never heard that before. Interesting.
That's right. If we talk about religious rhetoric, like religious rhetoric often has these sort of tropes or forms that you repeat over and over again.
Right.
Yeah. You know, with Trump, it is the sort of, you know, there's the trope of the strong big man who cries in front of Trump.
Who is going to write.
And that's right. And then also the very smart person, the scientist or egghead or doctor who is like startled by like Trump asking a question that has never been asked before. And the function of that trope is like, you know, beyond any rational meaning, it is like, right. Oh, you know, like this is a guy who's sharp and can, you know, outthink the experts.
Right. And is also, I think, importantly, in the dreamscape of MAGA world, is fighting for you somehow. You know, he's beating back the forces of environmentalism that will make cars less convenient, or you know, the shark loving environmentalists or what have you. So I think, you know, rather than, again, you know, pointing out for what feels like the millionth time, you know, this is a guy who is off the rails rhetorically and linguistically and mentally, I think it's more important to ask, what function do these performances serve in the kind of, you know, I guess to use a bogus term, the epistemic closure of the MAGA movement, that, you know, you're in this kind of insulated world where, and, you know, I referred to my old friend, Jeff Charlotte, had a very good Substack, because he watched the entire 5-hour build up to the rally and in Nevada and, you know, pointed out, which is true, that at all of these rallies, you always have a local preacher who is kind of working up the crowd for the moment when Trump appears, who is basically, you know, making the claim that here is your savior. You know, here is the, you know, this is the moment that we've all prayed for, worked for. He is, you know, going to be your vessel of deliverance. And in that context, you know, as absurd as this Shark Battery performance is, it is a kind of parable, you know.
Yeah,
it's a MAGA parable about how power is going to be used on your behalf again to defeat these, you know, conniving elites who are, you know, and it's a plug and play martyrology. So it, you know, yeah, it applies with equal force to the legal system that's currently, you know, in MAGA lore persecuting Trump. It applies to the deep state, however you choose to configure that. So, the political dilemma, I think, and as we enter the you know, main campaign season, is how much of this language will put off, you know, this kind of what I think of as an increasingly mythic faction of centrist swing voters, and how much of it, you know, they'll just kind of shrug off. Is right now, again, 8 years into this, there's this, you know, I think among the general public, if not the press, there's this, you know, kind of tolerance for all this as Trump being Trump. And it's frustrating, I think, that the Democrats aren't recognizing, you know, because I think if you put this in its full religious context, it makes it all scarier, right?
This guy
can say anything and it'll be treated as holy writ by his followers, and we're going to give him, you know, the nuclear suitcase.
I think that's exactly right. There's a couple of points to pick up on there. One of which is the earlier response, which, you know, is not entirely indefensible, but was always a kind of like fact check response, right? Like,
right,
Trump says outrageous things, we will fact check his claims.
Right.
And this is like a very common thing in 2016,
yep,
you know, like that he's, you know, like saying, spewing up more lies than,
right,
like, any,
you know, they toted up more than 10,000 lies, you know, consequential policy lies in addition to like made up shit. So,
which, like, you know, I mean, I think convinces maybe some people, but if you're like within the context of religion, I mean, that is basically like saying, like, well, come on, did he actually walk on water? You know,
can you actually turn
water into wine? Like, how does that, what's the mechanics? I, you know, like, you can't fact check a religious claim in the same way. The other aspect is, like, often this kind of fact-checking response, even though it's, I mean, I think it's perfectly justified to tone up his lies and contrast, you know, that's a good journalistic function, but, you know, it often misses the kind of, like, the humor of it, and the way in which part of the appeal is, like, he's letting his followers in on the joke. This is the Hannibal Lecter story. He likes to do this ironic phrase of, you know, like, well, there's this, you know, like, very good doctor, Hannibal Lecter, you know, like,
right,
you know, he wants to have you over
for dinner, but I'm bum,
which is like almost a classic, like, not even like, you know, shock jock. It's a vaudeville joke, right? Like,
it's lazy, you know, as humor, I think.
Doesn't
really succeed, and yet, you know, because it comes from the mouth of their anointed one, it doesn't really matter.
Yeah.
And Jeff Charlotte in his coverage, you know, pointed out what was the other sort of big gotcha line in the Las Vegas rally was when, you know, Trump was talking about the heat and how, you know, it would be bad if people started, you know, passing out from heat stroke, and said, you know, but then again, I don't really care about you. I care about your vote. Which is, you know, again, funny because it's true, but it's, he also went on to say, oh, the press will make a big deal about this, just you wait. And and they did. He was right. So, you know, there is this sense in which he is, you know, packaging his outrageous statements as kind of sugar highs for the faithful to say, like, look, it's this weird rhetorical move where he he can say, you know, I don't care about you, which I think is demonstrably true.
Yeah.
And yet, you know, it's also, we're all in on the joke here. And, you know, the real target is the press, who's going to run wild with this. And then they do. And he can say, look, I told you.
Well, he's kind of like a built in the sort of outraged MSNBC response into the joke. And it's part of the pleasure. Like, it's part of the pleasure.
Right. It's running the libs.
As was, you know, Shock Jock, it says of Don Imus or Rush Limbaugh, you know, part of the pleasure is knowing that there are other people out there who will, like, take this.
Their jaws clenched in outrage.
That's right. So, and I mean, furthermore, there's a kind of been a normalization of all this stuff. I mean, aside from the Las Vegas event that we were mentioning, you know, he spoke on Capitol Hill, also outrageously. And I just want to read the sort of AP tweet that came out for their article about this. Donald Trump made a triumphant return to Capitol Hill on Thursday, his first with lawmakers since January 6, 2021 attacks. Embraced by energized House and Senate Republicans who find themselves reinvigorated by his bid to retake the White House. Our mutual friend Brian Fiedler, quite rightly asked, did Donald Trump write this tweet? It is basically like just saying, like, you know, aside from the outrage response of the sort of centrist liberals, there's a, you know, more neutral media, and their response is just to take this as like, this is just good politics. Trump is like, we get triumphant.
Right. This is the leader's.
I think both the Las Vegas event and the return to Capitol Hill are fit well within the framework you're giving of a kind of religious revival and are very like worrying and upsetting for that very reason, where one sees both a mass movement and a political party, the elite of a political party, you know, like members of the House and Senate, like basically going in for a cult. And in some ways that all these outrageous statements, you know, the praise of Hannibal Lecter, the crazy tirade against sharks, they all work in a way that a religious cult works. I think it's often the case that in religious cults, the leader will make more and more outrageous claims and do more and more outrageous things as a way of testing the followers. This is how you separate out the sheep from the goat. Like, if you're really with me, you'll go along with everything. And
you're MAGA patriot, you will say, like, you know, when Trump says Milwaukee is a horrible city, you'll say, oh, he didn't really mean that. You know,
There's no limit to what we will allow him to do, and we'll always find excuses for him.
Right. And the press does connive in this. It's also true that Emma Demain, who's a great Capitol Hill reporter I formerly worked with at CQ, was, in the halls of the Capitol interviewing lawmakers. And she tweeted that every other political reporter was calling out to lawmakers to ask, did Trump make any jokes? You know, was he amusing and titillating? And it's just like, what purpose does that serve? I truly do not understand what these reporters are doing, except, I guess that was what their editors told them to go and find out.
So this is really just
this is a sidebar issue, but, you know, I still remember from the 2016 campaign, like how the political press marveled at how Trump gave derisive nicknames to his rivals and, you know, treating him like he was really a comic genius. And I think it needs to be just acknowledged at some point, the man is not funny. He is just simply incapable. I mean, he will sometimes, insult someone in a creative way. I'll give him that much. But, you know, this whole, like this Hannibal Lecter thing we were saying earlier,
it's a hack joke.
It's an old man joke, and it doesn't really land. So that is, again, another marker of the cult phenomenon. Like, you know, Marjorie Taylor Greene was, you know, she was fawning like he was, you know, a Tiger Beat centerfold when she was interviewed about his appearance on the Hill. And he was saying, like, how funny and sweet. And it's just like, you know, this is Marjorie Taylor Greene. You should not be looking at this as anything other than a pathological index, you know.
Yeah. And actually, I mean, Marjorie Taylor Greene, she also fits in well with the sort of religious thesis that you've been offering, which I think is the key thing.
At the Las Vegas rally, her big applause line was like, the Democrats are harping about how Trump is a felon. Well, you know what? The man I worship was a felon. And he was crucified on the cross. So,
But the literal quote is, the man I worship is also a convicted felon, and he was murdered on a Roman cross.
Right.
Which is like, I mean, this is like as far as you can go. I mean, like, Trump is Jesus. And it's worth maybe like, there's been a historical process at work, because in 2016, I mean, the evangelicals are actually quite suspicious of Trump for good reason, because this man is clearly like the most biblically illiterate politician that America's ever had. Clearly a long history of libertine sexual life. And they rationalized it, but he was promising things they wanted, and he gave them Mike Pence as VP in part
this was my last print feature for the Nation, you know, Lance Wallnau from the New Apostolic Reformation, which is the vanguard evangelical MAGA movement, created this whole fake idea of the Cyrus prophecy that Trump, like the ancient Persian king of Cyrus, was not of the faith, but an ally of Israel, and helped rebuild the temple. And this is biblical history repeating itself. And Trump, we have to recognize that Trump is, even though he's not himself what you would call an observant religious man. he is an instrument of the working out of divine history.
That's right. Yeah. And on a different level, a simple parallel argument would bring him to King David, you know, like also a man who was guilty of some sexual improprieties, lusted after other men's wives. But also an instrument of God. So yeah, I don't, I mean, but that is not, I mean, that has shifted, right? Like, I think once Trump was president and they saw he was doing what they wanted, he gave them those court justices, you know, he has not become, he's no longer like King David. You don't hear those arguments anymore.
No, they're going straight to Jesus now.
He's Jesus. Which is like that is an actual like shift. Now, I mean, in terms of like the religiosity, I mean, there's a couple of ways to think about it. One of which is, he's as you and I have both agreed, like totally not of a religious background, except what we talked about before, the power of positive thinking,
Norman
that
Vincent
sort of
Peale.
Mind cure version of evangelical Protestantism, which is not the Bible, but is how-to book for success,
arguably the American Bible,
it's the American Bible, but the other aspect is the entertainment, right? Like there's a way in which American Christianity has I'd even make a bigger argument, which is, I think the history of Christianity, the history of entertainment, have always been intertwined. And
back to your fellow Canadian, Amy Simple McPherson. Who migrated south and had a whole radio empire and was quite something.
That's right. I mean, yeah, but even like before then, like the great preachers of the, you know, the preachers that would go forward, you know, like, and they weren't necessarily, you know, the greatest like theologians or, you know, the most learned people, but there's that aspect. If you can speak dramatically, if you can speak, you know, with some humor, and address a crowd, and by that logic, I mean, like, Trump, is he a good Christian? Well, you know, was Jimmy Swagger a good Christian? Was Jim Baker a good Christian?
They played one on TV.
They played on TV, and you know, who are we? We're all sinners in the eyes of God. But they certainly had the ability to, you know, rile up the audience and to use not the sort of, you know, maybe doctrinal Christianity, but the sort of narrative Christianity, a theology of, you know, angels and demons and spiritual warfare.
Those are all New Apostolic Reformation key concepts that have advanced. You know, this is one of the great untold stories of January 6th, is that NAR preachers and apostles were everywhere on the ground preaching, you know, basically that the liberals and the deep state are demons. And this really violent rhetoric that fed directly into the insurrection. And because Mary Cheney successfully convinced the January 6th committee not to investigate the Christians, this isn't really part of the official narrative, but it's incredibly important. Matthew Taylor, who I interviewed for my Nation feature, has done great research and has a book coming out about how NAR was the vanguard of January 6th, essentially.
It's interesting that there's this like crucial religious element and there's a reluctance to talk about it. Yeah. I think for a variety of reasons, I think in a lot of the mainstream media, it's just pure ignorance. Like they don't have.
Yeah. They don't know about American religion at all. I can attest to that. And there's a fear, you know, I think this is why Mary Cheney was able to prevail. She's like, you don't want to get these people mad, you know, it's going to be, you know, ugly. And, you know, in point of fact, if you don't call them out, it's what we were saying earlier about the rhetoric. They just press on further. And this is all worrisome. It's part of the reason I don't think the Democrats really have a plan for what, you know, even should Biden win in November, there's going to be another January 6th, you know. And because they don't really understand the nature of the threat, they aren't making adequate preparations. So it's very worrisome.
You know, it's absolutely, absolutely worrisome. And one thing I think about, it's an issue you raised before, and I don't know if there's any like clear or hard and fast answers. To what extent should we be elevating like this Trump stuff? Like, are there actually, you know, right, like middle of the road people who can be scared by this? But I actually think like, you know, there was perhaps a mistake to deplatform Trump, or it might have made sense at a particular time. But like now, actually, I actually think getting people to listen to Trump. I think a lot of this stuff appeals to the MAGA base. Other people either can write it off, but I think if they hear enough of it, there's a lot of worrisome stuff. And I think his embrace of the January 6th felons as martyrs, I don't think that's a popular position. And I think that's a position would be an appeal to centrists. This would be like an appeal to just, you know, like a broad base of Americans who don't like insurrection.
Including sort of traditional country club Republicans, I don't think.
But also like hardcore Democratic, like people do not like what happened on January 6th. You know, they saw this as a real affront to democracy, quite rightly.
Indeed, it was an attempted coup. I do feel like, you know, Trump's conviction in Manhattan has emboldened the Democrats a bit. You know, they are using, you know, that as a cudgel. They're, you know, and they have already gotten out in front. We briefly alluded to Trump's sort of bizarre sideswipe of Milwaukee when he was meeting with Congress. And the DNC is now going to put up billboards quoting Trump saying Milwaukee is a horrible city when the RNC meets there. So I think they're gradually picking up what, you know, to me feels like it should have been front and center from the word go. But
And I think that's a good note to end on. I mean, I think it is good that this stuff is being more highlighted, and I think it would actually be even more effective if people had a cultural context to understand what Trump is actually saying. And it's to that end that I recommend both your column and your more recent features, both of which I'll link to in the show notes. So I think people should listen to Trump, but they should also understand where he's coming from. And read Chris Lieben. So
right, and also think about what his followers are hearing rather than what he, you know, how his utterances do or do not parse on a logical, you know, matrix. That ship has sailed, for better or worse, I think.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, you can fact check mythology. So right.
That should be, right under Democracy Dies in Darkness. I think that should be a journalism slogan.
Anyway. Okay. So on that note, I want to thank you again for appearing on the podcast, and we will talk again.
Excellent. Sure. Thanks again. Take care, Ajit.